Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to your podcast, New Books in Economic and Business History. I'm your host, Javier Mejia from Stanford University. And today I have the great pleasure to be with Juan Flores Endejas. He's head of the Paul Bayrock Institute of Economic History at the University of Geneva. And he's the author of two recently published books. The first one is Sovereign Debt Diplomacies, Rethinking Sovereign Debt from Colonial Empires to Hegemony. And the second one is Moral Hazard and Financial, Legal, and Economic Perspective. In both of these books, he is co-editor with a couple of co-authors. We're going to talk about that in a bit, but let me first say hi to Juan. Hi, Juan. Thanks for being here with us.
Hi, Javier. Thank you very much for inviting me.
So before talking about the books, I would like to hear more about you. So I know you for a while already, but give us some background of your life and your career. Where are you from? When did you decide to get involved in academia? Why did you think that economic history was an interesting field? Tell us a bit about how did you end up being the scholar that you are today?
Yeah, so that's a long story. No, I'm from Mexico City originally, and I'm an economist. So my undergrad is from economics, and then I did my PhD in Paris, in Sciences Po Paris, and also in applied economics. Then at some moment, from my different courses and interests, more and more, I was pushed to economic history. I had the impression that pretty much of the core about our way we think about economics today is pretty much related with history. You know? So, you know, when do countries actually become underdeveloped? When they decide to push certain amount or groups of economic policies, you know, trade, colonialism, and all that, and those were topics that I found very interesting and fascinating. That were pretty much in line with what I wanted to do. And what I want to do is really to understand about why, you know, there's the typical cliche question about why some countries are rich and why others are poor. And more the response that I found were related with the literature and economic history. And my best courses, I would say, when I was in Paris doing my PhD were in economic history. So in a sense, I was pretty much pushed by my interest and then by my professors and by the literature. And then there was another major factor, which is the discovery of archives. No, I have never done archives. So I'm not a historian, so I didn't really learn it. But so when I started to go to the archives back in, well, it was in Paris, actually. So, you know, I started going to the Crédit Lyonnais. Crédit Lyonnais, it was one of the most important banks back in the late 19th century. And Crédit Lyonnais, they had lots of documents about their investments in Latin America, and particularly in Argentina. So I started my research on Argentina, because Argentina back then was supposed to be the United States of South America. And so I started to look at the documents, and they were great because they had lots of statistics, lots of correspondence, the way people perceived the country, and also about financial crisis. I started my PhD in the late 1990s, beginning of the 2000s, and we were pretty much then interested into financial crisis. No, it was the moment of financial liberalization. The debates about capital controls, about the benefits and costs of foreign investment. And so more and more I got involved into this literature, and I was discovering the archives and, you know, what French investors thought about Argentina, the future of Argentina, the future of Latin America. you know, how they proceed, for instance, also the political situation in Mexico and Porfirio Diaz and so on. So I got pretty involved into all these kind of questions. And then I decided to do my master dissertation and then, or my second master dissertation and then my PhD on financial crisis in Latin America from the late 19th century up to 1914. No, and so it was pretty much, you know, combining my own interest in economics and economic development with what I discovered, which is to do my research in archives, no, and see all these old documents and, you know, untouched documents. I think I was the first person to look at these old papers, and so I just got fascinated about these issues. No, and then of course I discovered that it was not that simple, you know, to convince people about what you think you discovered about your arguments, and you know, and then develop a theory and so on. It's something that comes afterwards. I just followed my interest, and I think that, you know, those kind of let's say archival discoveries, and then the fact that I linked it with the problems of development and financial crisis in Latin America, I think that that created interest both in Europe and in Latin America and in Mexico. I thought I found like a market, and in a sense, I was happy with what I was doing, and I'm still happy. I think it was like the very beginning of a career, so it's more than 20 years now. No? And I still work in a lot of sense in the same topics. So I guess at some moment, like it's something that enlightening, no? And so that's the way I started. Yeah.
So let me ask you something a bit in that line. When you describe how you realized that your research had this market both in Latin America and in Europe, I wonder how is that interaction between the two like parts of academia, right? So they're somewhat disconnected, you would assume, right? Academia in Latin America and academia in Europe. You have been exposed to both as a student. You were telling me that you studied in Mexico and then in Europe, but I know that you've been also a visiting professor in Latin America, so you're familiar with the setting. How do you compare the two environments? What are the bridges between them? Do you think that there's some potential synergies that are not being exploded? I don't know. I would like to hear your impression about the interaction between Latin America and Europe.
Mm-hmm. I think both academic worlds are very different. So in a lot of senses, they are very disconnected, meaning that, you know, you have a national setting. And then, I mean, even if we look about Europe, if we talk about Europe and we talk about Latin America, of course, you have every time each national gauge, which is different. No? I may start talking about Mexico and you will tell me, you know, in Colombia is different. So, no. So let's say that there is also a principal component analysis that has to be done. No? So I am talking about averages and about common trends. So in that regard, I still think that we could do this analysis and say, you know, in Europe, there are certain common elements, and in Latin America, there are also certain common elements, and those are different. No, so I would say that Europe is pretty much concerned about certain topics. I mean, if we look about economic history, you know, industrialization and migrations and, you know, the effects of colonial expansionism and so on. Whereas in Latin America, you know, there are the other topics, no? The effects of colonialism for another perspective, but also, you know, political instability, the effects of bad institutions and so on. So in a sense, each region has its own interest. But within each interest, you still have common ground. No, in this common ground, as I said, there are many things that can be communicated and where there can be lots of interactions. No, and I was talking about colonialism, and you know, I mean, Europeans could think about colonialism because they think that that's a major element when they talk about industrialization. No, and you know, where do we receive the commodities, or you know, what's the effect of having these territories, or having more trade with this specific region, you know, with India, or, you know, Northern Africa in the case of the French and so on. in Mexico, we would talk about colonialists, but mainly from with Spain or with Portugal in another period. And then we would see how globalization worked in the 19th century. Well, but there are still some common, you know, threats, and we still have common analytical frameworks. You know, we have all these conferences where we discuss these kinds of issues. We talk about conditions of life conditions and wages, and we see what the other is doing. I think more and more. Whereas perhaps in the 1980s, still, you know, we had our specific publications. It was much more difficult to get access to other publications beyond the, you know, the national publication or those that are the most known. For instance, let's say Journal of Economic History and so on. Less known journals were more difficult to get access to. No. And now that's not more the case. With internet, you can almost get access to anything. I mean, of course, that depends upon the resources that each university has. But in general, I would say that many of the publications are available via internet for most of the people. So that creates both, you know, a common language, and then, you know, that's reinforced by this common interest, even if we have different perspectives, no? So Europeans would think about industrialization. We would think about the causes of underdevelopment. But it's still two sides of the same coin, you know? And so in that regard, I would say that you know, that there are many, many ways to coordinate, to cooperate, and also to hear to each other. I would say that there is an evolution towards more communication, towards let's say more findings on common interests, and therefore I would say that in a sense, academic globalization, we can talk about academic globalization, it's ongoing, no? So perhaps in terms of trade, they will go backwards, perhaps, I don't know, what's happening in the world. But I would say that academic globalization, for the good and for the bad, it's still ongoing, no? So, and I'm happy about that. I share both cultures of academic world. I mean, I like it in Europe. I like to talk to Italians and French and so on, and they all have their own also national particularities. But I love it also to go to Brazil or to Uruguay, to Argentina, and talk about my things and hear to them. I think that's just great. That's a true global community. And I think that, well, the pandemic had perverse effects, but Zoom also opened other possibilities. So in that regard, I think we will still find our way to continue to be global. No?
Right. Let's get to the books that you recently published, because I think they highlight fairly well what you're describing, this ability to talk to this global audience, both in Europe and not only in Latin America, but other parts of what you could call the global South. Because, for instance, in Sovereign Debt Diplomacies, which, by the way, you edited with Pierre Penet, you explore a bit that tension between borrowers and creditors, and that usually means different countries in this two, like, spectrums of global power dynamics. Why don't we talk a bit about that, but why don't we start with the most basics? Why do you argue that sovereign debt is special, right? Why do we need an entire book about sovereign debt and not one that fits to a larger type of debt?
Yeah, so, okay, I see. Perhaps before answering to your question, I might go backwards about these tensions that you were naming. And the other tension that I did not mention, and which I found challenging precisely for writing this book, was the fact that this is an interdisciplinary effort. No? So there are tensions not only between different geographic regions, there are tensions also between different academic disciplines. No? And so, for instance, my co-author, so Pierre Penet, it's not only that he's French, but he's also a sociologist, no? And that means that, I mean, there has to be a will also to engage into a dialogue with people from different social sciences, from different academic traditions, no? And backgrounds and so on. So that's one thing, no? And the other is about sovereign debt. So sovereign debt, as you might know, sovereign debt is a huge issue among economists, no? And sovereign debt is in particular, so it's debt. You have a borrower, you have a creditor. And the particularity it is that you have a government, which is a borrower. No? So compared to a private credit borrower, it's very easy because if, you know, if a borrower does not pay, a private borrower, it's very easy. You just sue him and, you know, there are courts and that's it. No? You just say it's assets or the goods or, you know, the car or whatever it is. If it's a consumer just, you know, doesn't buy its consumption anymore, it's easy. You just take it away, no? And you have the courts and you have the judges and everything. The old system will support the creditor. With sovereign debt, it's a bit different. No, you have a government, so there is no international court which can arrange these kind of problems. No, so you have this what we call sovereign debt disputes. No, so you have creditors, you have borrowers, and every time in history we see that some moment a government is no longer able to repay its debts as it has been stipulated in a contract. No, so that's one thing. So I mentioned contract, no? And, you know, we economists don't look at contracts. It's lawyers. So you have to bring law scholars if you want to understand sovereign debt, no? So that's the first thing. And the other thing is that, okay, so sovereign debt is particular because you have governments and we have no international tribunal. The other main motivation behind, and I would say that's a major component of the book, is the fact that if you look at how sovereign disputes are taking place today and how they are solved today, and you talk to a historian, this historian will find a lot of similarities, parallels with how sovereign disputes were being solved in the past, with how creditors had to manage these issues at different times in history. And what we wanted to look at in this book is to see how sovereign disputes have been solved in a long-term perspective and whether they have been continuities and contrasts. And what you will find is that we actually have a lot of continuities. No? So the way Venezuela sovereign debt has been managed, I would say there are many parallels with the 19th century. No? Or the way Greece, that is not an underdeveloped country, the way the European Union managed the sovereign debt crisis that Greece had in the 2010-11 is very similar to the way it was managed, also in Greece, back in the late 19th century. No. And so it's incredible that we have many patterns and ways in which we see and perceive sovereign debt that have to do with the past, no? With a colonial political framework that still persists today. No? And, you know, when we talk about sovereign debt, it's not only that you talk about the market, because there are many different consequences behind. And when we talk about these consequences, you have to go beyond talking about only economic issues. You have to say something about politics. You have to say something about law. You have to say something about sociology. And therefore, Pierre Penet and I, we believed that it would be interesting to look at these continuities in particular and differences in a multidisciplinary framework. And therefore, we believed that it was a good idea to have this book and to bring together law scholars, sociologists, political scientists, historians, and so on, and to have a common dialogue about how should we analyze and deepen into these kind of issues. No, and that's the result is this book that you're looking at.
Let me ask you about those patterns that you're describing. So if you would have to mention those continuities, what would be the most important ones? What things have been there since the 19th century that are still common practices in the way that sovereign debt disputes are dealt with? And why are the forces, or what are the forces that sustain those continuities? Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I think that's very interesting. I would say there are two things. One continuity that we observe is a persistent effort by governments and creditors to institutionalize the way we manage sovereign debt disputes. No. So You may think, for instance, contracts. No, you had sovereign debt contracts since, at least what I know and what we say in the book also, since at least the 19th century. You know, so there are contracts. And it's very interesting because you have a contract, even if in principle the state is sovereign. No, so in principle there is no way in which a national legal framework can do something about it. But you still have contracts, and you have lawyers trying to, you know, develop contracts in order to avoid any kind of risk in the future if a borrower does not pay its debts. Okay, so that's one thing. And even today we still have contracts. And we manage or we discuss about how these contracts have to be framed. No? And we talk, for instance, about collective action clauses. No? Of course, now today, the way we perceive sovereign immunity has changed. But still, we observe this fact that there is a willingness to have a contract, despite the fact that, and I arrived to this second continuity, that at the very end, what we do with sovereign debt is that we negotiate politically the way we solve sovereign debt disputes. No. So in a sense, even if we have contracts and even if we always wanted to have some institutional framework to deal with sovereign debt disputes and that we develop contracts and clauses and so on, at the very end, sovereign debt disputes is about politics. No. And so today, if we think, for instance, about Venezuela, or we talk about the Chinese loans, or if we talk about the World Bank loans, it's all about politics. No. And if we look about the 19th century, the way sovereign debt disputes were solved, it was also about politics. No. So if you think about Egypt, for instance, Egypt, there was a sovereign debt dispute. So Egypt defaulted back in the 1870s. Early 1870s, and because there was no solution into that sovereign debt dispute, and because there was a geopolitical interest behind, at the very end, what we ended up with the establishment of a colonial regime in Egypt. But it all started as a sovereign debt dispute. No? And, you know, you can see Mexico, for instance, 1861, 62, again, there was a sovereign debt dispute. And again, you have the French saying, okay, you know, we have a particular interest, a territorial interest in having some kind of a regime that is friendly to us in Mexico. And so they managed to invade the country. They have a new government to be established. And they started, you know, having a specific indirect control in Mexico, and in a sense, well, that did not work well, and then they had to go back, and then the debt was repudiated. No, so in a sense, there was a political will to end up these sovereign debt disputes by having an establishment of a pseudo-colonial regime. No, so in a sense, what we're doing is that we are putting together colonialism and colonial history with sovereign debt. No. And so the way the French manage Mexico's economy is not very different than the way in which you have these supervision bodies today, say in Greece or say by the IMF missions in the 1980s. So in a sense, there is a sense of control into other countries' public finances, other countries' monetary policies. So in that regard, you know, you start with a sovereign debt dispute, and that leads to a limit which could be extreme, to a limit into sovereignty of the borrower. No? So when I say extreme, it's the establishment of a colonial regime. Now it's not that extreme, meaning we have no colonialism anymore in that regard, but we still have some kind of a limitation to say sovereignty of a specific country. No? So you see, I start with from debt, from an economic perspective, and I have to go into the political sphere. So I need a political scientist. I talk about contracts. So I need a law scholar to explain me why we need contracts into this specific setting, knowing that we have a sovereign entity that is being the borrower. And we need a sociologist to understand all this social implication about the tools that are developed in order to have this link from sovereign debt into colonialism. You know? So that's why we think that it's very important to understand these continuities, that you need an interdisciplinary approach, you know, to get all these different factors into one specific analysis.
So I want to ask you a bit more about that, about the process of getting together the right team to think about this issue. But before that, I would like to go deeper into this things that persisted and those that changed, right? So you describe, for instance, how European powers had this more, let's say, aggressive approach in the 19th century. And although today the approach remains quite interventionist, if you want, it is not that aggressive or violent. What are those discontinued? Is it only the level of and the acceptance of violence in the process, or what are the things that have changed? And why have they changed? Why do you experience this? And in the, I don't know if you can only talk about two periods or more. I think you offer a more granular chronology in the book, but tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, that's a very good question, Javier. So, if I may say something that changed a lot, it's the famous gunboat diplomacy. No, it's not that, you know, there is a country that declares default and you will have the gunboats the next day. No? And perhaps we had it sometimes in the past, no? And you had it, you know, with the US in Central America at the beginning of the 20th century. We had it with the British Empire in the 19th century, or even the French did the same. So in a sense, that kind of resolutions to sovereign debt disputes, it's kind of the past, right? So I don't expect it to be the case today, or at least I hope it will not be the case. And now today, with today's times, we don't really know what to expect, right? But it strikes me a bit, if I have to talk about one period where you had lots of changes, it was the post-1945 period. No. So in general, what you saw in the 19th century, that's something that was pretty much common in the past, was the fact that in principle, a government of a creditor country, say Britain, France, Prussia, or whatever it is, they would support its bondholders. And they would support it the more if there were also a geopolitical interest behind. No? And that was very clear. So when you see about 45, and about the period that starts in the post-World War II period, what you observe is that that's no longer the case. Meaning, the U.S. in the 1920s becomes the major creditor country in the world. No. Then in the 1930s, you have a major wave of defaults. So there is the Great Depression, and many governments are no longer able to repay its debts. No. And it's not only Latin America. No. You talk about many different countries in the world, including also European countries. No. So lots of Eastern European countries, even Germany, Austria, and so on, default on their debts. No. So that's a major thing. And then 45, so the war ends, and in a sense, you know, since in the late 1930s, there are also many different governments that think that they should be repaying their debts. No, so there is a willingness from, you know, U.S. bondholders, also European bondholders, and also different governments that, you know, these disputes have to be managed and resolved in, you know, one way or the other. Okay, but this time, what it's very particular about this period is the fact that now you have the government of the United States, which should be traditionally supporting its bondholders, private investors mainly, that stops doing that. And for once, they start supporting borrowers. No. And that's mainly one reason. And it is first because there is a geopolitical interest, whose name is World War II. And then it's a Cold War. No. So, and that's very important. So debt is no longer a major issue. No? That's the other part. Because debt is no longer a priority for the U.S. government. It becomes just a thing that has to be solved one way or the other. And the U.S. is rather willing to look for political support. No. talking about the Cold War, and also to look for trade partners, you know, commodities and, you know, markets for the industrial goods and so on. And that means that the U.S. government becomes pretty much involved into the negotiations between private bondholders and governments, you know, borrowing governments from Europe or Latin America or whomever. And then the U.S. government believes that the priority should not be rather, or should not be the repayment of debts, but should rather be the world's economic recovery. And they start pushing and exerting pressure upon its investors to have them accepting the offers from borrowers. So if you look at the terms and conditions under which these debt disputes were being solved, what you will see is that they were pretty much in advantage of borrowers. So Mexico, say, the government had in 1942 a haircut, which would be the losses imposed upon investors of about 90%. So Mexico got away from owing a dollar into owing only 10 cents. No. And that was only one country among a lot of others, no, including Germany. 1953, the Germans managed quite well the amount of debt that they had to repay in the future. No? And that was because that was only one issue among many others. And the idea was to, you know, recover, have some recovery from the world economy, you know, have a boost on international trade and so on. So in that regard, I would say that if politics is so important to explain how sovereign debt is resolved or debt disputes are resolved, well, for once, you have the major hegemonic power supporting rather borrowers because it wanted borrowers also to play the game and start doing trade, buy American exports, U.S. exports, and also support U.S. in its, let's say, Cold War, or go along into their own geopolitical interests. So that was so specific. Because at some moment, that would start to change. No? And so you have the emergence of the IMF, the emergence of the World Bank, the emergence of the Export-Import Bank, and more, what you would observe is that these new institutions or these new entities would start conditioning their loans to having these countries or these borrowers having settled their disputes with investors. So you have the first loans from the IMF and the first loans from the World Bank to Brazil and Chile and so on. They were all conditioned upon having these countries having settled their disputes with investors, right? And in that regard, you see again that little by little, up to the 1960s and 70s, they start getting more and more power, becoming more and more important, developing what we now know as conditionality. And then more and more, again, all this framework would favor, again, creditors. No? So I would say there is a small window in which things were different. Debt was no longer so important. What was important was economic recovery. And therefore, what you would see is that the balance of power between creditors and borrowers would go rather more in favor of the borrowers. And that changed very quickly. No? If we arrive up to the 1980s and this major Latin American debt crisis, you see very clearly that, you know, this burden sharing from this economic and financial crisis in Latin America favored actually creditors rather than borrowers. No? So that's something that changed completely from this specific period that was, you know, the post-World War II period.
Let me ask you something about that, because it strikes me... The position of specifically the U.S. on favoring the borrowers. And I guess my question there is, what was the reaction of the investors locally? I guess, like, how do you deal with a government that is not supporting you? It seems, and I would like also to hear a bit about this, how the emergence of the IMF and some other of these international organizations were somewhat designed to kind of substitute other tools to still protect this community of investors. But how was the, I guess the communication or the relationship in the US between the investors and the government, and how this related to the emergence of this of these organizations.
Yeah, so of course, well, investors in the US, they were not happy of not having this report. So they lobbied the government quite a lot. No. So this lobbying had not the desired effect at the beginning, precisely because of these priorities of the US government towards rather international trade or promoting exports. So you had another group. If we enter into this political economy analysis, you have exporters. No, you have the interest of the own U.S. government regarding its political aims and so on. And in that regard, investors were not as powerful as they have been before. But again, that changed rapidly. And for instance, I mean, the traditional story here is the story of the Export-Import Bank that starts, you know, having one specific target, and that was to promote U.S. exports, you know? And that was the absolute priority. And that changed at some moment. And more investors pushed to have the Export-Import Bank conditioning its loans, having these settlements with investors. No? So that was one thing. So that was pretty much a result of lobbying, no, from U.S. investors that they eventually led to an outcome. And that outcome was this conditioning from the Export-Import Bank towards borrowing governments. And the other was the major agent, I would say, is the World Bank. And it is the case of the World Bank that pretty much of its financing, at least at the very beginning, was that the World Bank also issued bonds in international markets. And, you know, that meant that investors were supposed to finance the World Bank. And the World Bank would therefore not be willing to finance a borrower that in the first place does not pay the main financiers of the World Bank, which is the investors. No, so investors wanted the World Bank. No, they were financing the World Bank to support these countries, and therefore they have the power to impose upon the World Bank this idea that they have to condition their own loans to borrowing countries. No, so in a sense, there was this idea that the World Bank was being financed by investors, and then also the fact that investors could lobby the U.S. government to continue pushing to have the Export-Import Bank conditioning its loans to governments. So we have to recall that back in those days, you did not have this market mechanism. You know, if today there is a government that does not repay its debts, it's very easy, you know, they are excluded from the bond market. No? So a government default is no longer able to issue bonds. No? And that was pretty much the same as in the 19th century. In the post-45 period, it's very different because these financial markets are quite regulated and they're quite closed. No? Because, you know, the financial shape of the world was quite in a bad condition. No? So in that regard, that meant that the only way in which a government could obtain foreign support was through these major agencies, the World Bank, IMF, Export-Import Bank, so public entities. No, so that was the moment which we have the rise of the state. No, so that meant that it was quite easy to, you know, target these specific public entities and then, you know, ask them to, you know, put some pressure on these defaulting borrowers into dealing and managing their disputes with private investors. And eventually that was the revenge system, I would say, of the creditors, and they obtained what they wanted. No. It's just that at the very moment, at the very beginning, well, borrowers could get along in a relatively favorable way and a favorable position. Yeah.
Let me ask you something that, I mean, it goes beyond your book, but I've always been curious about this, and I'm not exactly sure how this even like fits into like the broader literature, but I want to hear your opinion. So there's this recent, I guess, sympathy for ideas that many people would label as modern monetary theory that would argue that a state has pretty much complete flexibility to issue debt in their own currency. And the debt issues sound a trivial matter, right? And the whole narrative that you've been describing is how painful it can be to go to international markets and be financed by them, right? So I guess my question would be, and this is not, I don't expect you to tell me like how theoretically you think about this, but like, is it that in the past, states were just stupid and didn't think that it was a good idea just to issue bonds locally? What, why would any state go to international markets? And I start to imagine that you're going to tell me that it's because local markets didn't exist, but I really want to know what, how you think about this. What's the evidence that it's around this? Is there a conversation around these issues now? Was there a conversation back then in the 19th century, for instance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a super interesting and complex question. No? So I would start saying that here we're talking a lot, or related with your question, we're talking a lot about financial underdevelopment. No? Because if you can raise money in your own currency at a domestic level, of course that would be the ideal. No? Because one country that issues bonds or go and borrows abroad in dollars and euros and so on these foreign currencies, there is always this exchange risk, no? Meaning at some moment if your currency depreciates, you will have trouble, no? So ideally, and if you see the financial development of many countries, including Scandinavian countries, no? Scandinavian countries were pretty much frequent borrowers at the beginning of the 19th century. And then at some moment they disappear. And they disappear from London and Paris, you know, the main international financial centers, because they could issue their bonds at a local level. No? We then got the gold standard and it made no difference, but in a sense, it was a difference. No? And that meant that they could resort to their own local financial markets. Well, in cases of underdeveloped countries, that's not so easy. First, because precisely the capital markets are much more restrained, they're much limited in their capacity to finance these governments. And also because the currencies are very unstable. No? And that leads to a major problem, which is known in the literature today as original sin. Original sin means precisely the fact that if you want to attract borrowers, you cannot do it in your own currency. You have to use a foreign currency. No? So in a long history exists about these countries not being able to borrow in their own currency. And this is Mexico, Brazil, Chile, and any Latin American country that you might imagine. No. So these countries had to borrow in foreign currencies. And some moment, you know, there is a devaluation or there is a loss in the currency's value. And then, you know, because the government, the main revenue comes from, you know, local resources, that means at some moment the government will be unable to repay its debts, mainly because, you know, the value in foreign currency of these local revenues, well, it falls. And then you're no longer able to repay the service of the debt. You know, year after year, you have to pay something, right? Well, the interesting part about this is that at some moment in the 1990s and 2000s, these underdeveloped countries started to actually issue bonds in international markets in their own currencies. So you have Chileans, Mexicans, Brazilians, mainly Brazilians or Chileans. They're issuing in Chicago, New York, and in Tokyo and so on. They're issuing bonds in their currency. So in a sense, that was an exit from this original sin story. No? First, two for once, and also partly because at some moment, you know, there were lots of liquidity, and here we're talking before the 2008 crisis. That meant that investors internationally were looking for more risky assets. No, and that helped. No? And you had two Brazilians and Chileans, and so on. They were issuing bonds internationally, bonds nominated in their own currency. So in Chilean pesos, and Brazilian reals, and Mexican pesos, and so on. What happens? The thing is that you don't resolve completely the fact that your currency is very volatile. You know, for many different reasons. There we should enter into why they are so volatile, but still they are volatile. And when they are volatile and, you know, there is a major event, an external shock like a pandemic or a war, whatever it is, and then investors would look into safe assets, it does not mean that you got rid from this original sin story. Why? But because what these investors could do is just, you know, get rid of these currencies, you know, and they would sell these bonds and then move to some safe assets, no? And they would buy US bonds or German bonds or Swiss bonds or whatever it is. So the result would be the same, meaning that at some moment the bonds denominated in reales or in Mexican pesos or in pesos, they would fall. And obviously, if you want again to borrow, it would be very difficult. No, so in that regard, it's still a major problem. No? And I would say that the basic source, the fundamental source, it's the fact that there are underdeveloped financial markets still in all these countries. So if you want to get rid of these original sin problems, you have to develop your own financial and domestic markets. No, and something that it's still to be done. I would say that even if you see Brazil or Chile mainly, they have moved forward. They have done some progress. We're still very far away from the ideal setting, no? And the ideal setting is to have the government being able to do this consumption smoothing and be able to, you know, to borrow in hard times and then repay in good times, no? Like, you know, the Germans or the Swiss and so on, no? And that's something that we still have to do. And we haven't been able to do that. That's the major challenge, I would say, in a few words, in a very simplistic way.
Right. I mean, it's very interesting that, and as you mentioned, like all the answers that you provide to these questions, they indeed involve the perspective of not only economists, but historians, legal scholars, sociologists, right? Like you describe markets as this not abstract entity, but as a institution that has a legal background and that different agents perceive differently, and it has this not fully rational perspective behind that. And what you do in your book, and not only Sovereign Debt, but also in Moral Hazard, is bringing together a large group of scholars with different expertises. And I'm curious about what's the process behind that. Like, how do you first get to know who's the right people to be part of one of these volumes? How do you manage to keep it coherent without constraining too much the creative process of each author? How does that work? Even like, and if you want to be completely intuitive about it, that'd be nice. Like, how do you tell? Do you first gather the people and you tell them what to write? Do you know people that are working on different things and then you just pick them? Tell us a bit about that process of editing a collective volume.
Yeah, that's a good one. I would say, first of all, it's perhaps about reading and being interested in what other colleagues from other fields are doing, you know, and precisely in the kind of subjects and topics that you're interested on. You know? So I would say, as an economist and as an economic historian, we have this, you know, pattern into looking into our own works, and we rarely look into what others are doing, you know, sociologists, political scientists, or law scholars, even less. You know? So at some moment, I mean, I would say the first thing is to break these frontiers, because these are frontiers that we have only in our minds. And in a sense, the fact that, you know, I'm pretty much, of course, interested into debt issues. And I know that there are people from other fields that are interested in those same issues, but they just look at differently. And when you start reading their texts, or, you know, their papers, their books and so on, you realize that, in fact, you have lots of things to learn from them. No, so that's the first. There is an openness of the spirit that you need to have, no, in order to be willing to engage into a dialogue with them. And then, so that's the first thing. So to be familiar, or try to be familiar, even if you don't really understand everything and that you don't have all the background, so on. And once you get starting them, then you start also going to their conferences or to start talking to them on, you know, even, you know, within in the same faculty, in the same building, in the same university, you start talking to them. And then at some moment you realize that the common ground, it's bigger than what you have imagined for a beginning, no? And so you start talking to them. And I like, for instance, there are some law scholars that when they talk to economists, they say, you know, I can't understand all your equations and all your models, so just present me the toy bottle. Tell me the intuition behind. And then you would have a law scholar being able to comment and say something about this model, no? Despite the fact that not all the math and not all the technicities will be understood. But even despite that, we will have them, you know, getting to the specific most important points, because you have, of course, at the very beginning, you have the right question. No, once you get the right question, then you start to talk about these different approaches, and you know, then you it's like, you know, there was a colleague of mine who said, you know, you economists are all, you know, these guys that are blind and they try to describe the elephant, and you know, one will describe the tail and the other, you know, the ear and the other, and every time it will be different. But once you start to talk to each other, you would realize it's the same animal, no? And so at some moment, when at least in Sovereign Debt, I got involved with all these law scholars at first informally, and then at some moment we started to talk about all these continuities, and then with historians we talk about colonial studies and the fact that, you know, debt and colonialism is so intertwined, and so we started to create a group and you know, go to different conferences and organize panels and so on. And at some moment we thought it would be a good idea to have all this common, you know, edited volume, and at some moment we had these ideas to identify the continuities, this contrasts, and put everybody together and comment each other's work, and then you see that's actually quite fun, no? Because you really have, first of all, to be able to explain your main points to a wider audience, to people from different disciplines, and then to also to get these different challenging questions from these colleagues that, you know, they bring you out of the box into your which you are into, and then you realize it's interesting and it's rich and it's challenging. It's really challenging, and I would say at the very end you're happy because it's like you understand a different language. And so you understand something, you learn something different, and you go beyond what you were thinking. And I think that's very grateful. I'm very happy with it. I mean, I should be the guy to say that, but I'm very happy with the results.
It is a great book. Both of them are great books. I can tell you. We're about to get to the end of our conversation, but before that, there's this question that I asked all my guests, which is why writing a book and not doing something else with your life, right? Which probably would be writing an article, or maybe would be doing something fun with your life. But I would like to add a dimension to that question, considering and going back to the beginning of our conversation. How important do you think that the fact that you're in Europe has been for the decision of writing a book? I was talking to Thomas Piketty the other day, and he said, you know, I think if I wouldn't have moved to France, probably I would have never decided to write the books that I wrote, because the incentives that I had in the US were aligned in a different direction. Do you think that if you would have stayed in Mexico, for instance, you would have been writing this type of products, this type of books? Or you would be doing something different?
I think that's the most difficult question to answer. I mean, I couldn't say about the counterfactual, so I don't imagine these different lives. But what I liked about writing a book is that you can really give it a thought. Sometimes writing articles means that you have to move fast and you have to have one idea, you have a limited space and so on. Whereas when you have a book, you can also include into the analysis the different perspectives and the thoughts you've been having yourself in order to express something, to willing to say something to the world. No, and in that regard, I would say deepening into my thoughts, explaining the analysis I'm doing, it's almost, you know, having a thought loud. if you're talking. And in that regard, I would say that going into a book rather than a paper or a short text, it's much richer and much more interesting. You know, it's because you really have to deepen and then also face also the doubts that you have. You know, in a paper you just grab the idea and that's it, and that's the idea. And you have to convince the reader, and there is no time, there is no space, there is no nothing. So you have an idea and you have to convince. And I would say that in a book you are more transparent into the fact that you have to take into account much more elements, and you have the space, you have the time, and in that regard, so you have the different approaches, perspectives. You can explain the discussion and the different debates that are in the literature, and you can do it that completely, you know, openly, and in the way you understand it. So in that regard, I would say that the book has a major advantage, you know, over everything else. And now that I discovered, because in a sense, this Sovereign Debt Disputes, Sovereign Debt Diplomacies was my first book. You know? And so I discovered while I was talking to the other authors, my co-author, and also writing myself these different chapters, I discovered that I could say many more things that I would have been able to say in an article. So in that regard, I'm happy with the experience, and I will repeat definitively. And I definitely recommend.
Great, Juan. And I'm very happy that you took the risk to write a book. So Sovereign Debt Diplomacy is a fascinating book. I was very glad of having the chance to read it. I highly recommend it. I learned a lot, and I learned a lot talking to you today. Let me thank you again, and see you soon.
Yeah, thank you, Heber. Thank you for this kind and interesting interview.